Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Last week, my guest was William Finnegan, a distinguished political journalist, book author, and correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. But last week, we were talking about his other life as a passionate surfer who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book called Barbarian Days about his lifelong obsession with this arcane pursuit. This week, Bill is back with us to talk about his work as a journalist. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to be here, Court.
Glad to have you back. I struggled a bit to decide how to describe the kind of journalism you do. You've won awards for public interest journalism and social justice journalism and are sometimes described as a war correspondent. I called you a political journalist. And I imagine that being categorized doesn't mean much to you, but if you had to define it, how would you describe what you do?
I think political journalist is actually pretty good. I mean, I tend to write about politics and power, whether it's, you know, conflict or something more subtle, but very, very broadly defined, it's usually got some politics in it. But the form is, I mean, The New Yorker publishes very long pieces, sometimes described as long-form narrative journalism, where we, you know, have the freedom to be way outside the sort of news style and write more like, to use all the sort of techniques of fiction, you know, dialogue and scene and narrative without a kind of news pyramid shape.
Mm-hmm. How did you first find this particular calling as a political journalist?
Well, I used to be a fiction writer when I was in school and after graduate school. I was still writing novels. And then while bumming around in my 20s, surfing here and there, one of the jobs I got to support that life was teaching high school in Cape Town, South Africa, in one of the townships outside Cape Town. I was teaching in a black high school. This is the bad old days of apartheid. And that turned out to be a very intense year. That is, the students went out on strike for 3 months and turned into quite a, you know, protesting apartheid in education.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up being quite a confrontation with the state. A lot of violence and a lot of my colleagues and our students were arrested, and people were hurt and killed. And we kept going to school each day, even though there weren't ordinary classes. And the whole year was just this kind of ferocious exposure to political conflict. And I really came to admire some of the anti-apartheid activists. I got to know students, colleagues, other people in that place. And by the time that year was over, I found I was really only interested in writing about politics, writing about power, writing nonfiction. And so I started, you know, sending queries to American magazines, writing travel journalism for magazines in Australia as well. But that's when I really got started as a political journalist, was after living in Cape Town.
I know it led to your first published book called Crossing the Line, A Year in the Land of Apartheid, which came out in 1986 and actually was selected by the New York Times Book Review as one of the 10 best nonfiction books of the year. So I guess that obviously gave you big league stature, but I think your career in political journalism began well before that, as you just described, right? So what was your first published article about?
Well, I did a bunch of kind of beginner pieces, sort of travel pieces. I think my first political piece for an American magazine was a sort of letter from Sri Lanka, where I'd lived before I got to South Africa, but it'd been quite an interesting place and kind of hard to understand from, I was living in a village down the coast, you know, surfing and, but also trying to understand the place broadly through my neighbors, through the people I got to know there and what I could learn about Sri Lanka. So there was a piece I wrote about for Mother Jones magazine about, this kind of life in this village and what I got to understand from the ground level, as it were, about Sri Lanka. This is before the civil war there, although I'd later realized that I was seeing some of the seeds of it, some of the incredible ethnic resentment of Tamils. This is among the Sinhalese, and but I did not see that war coming. And then I wrote about South Africa, but not so much. I was so close to the situation in South Africa, I found it hard to write about it first. I wrote one article about teaching and was kind of frustrated with the length. And that's what led to my first book, when I finally kind of got over myself and decided it was time to write about South Africa, something I really knew about.
I think some of your work, or a lot of times your work, is described as being sort of almost anthropological in its depth of describing the people. And I suspect that maybe surfing around the world on foot, pretty much on a dollar a day or whatever, than living in exotic villages where few Westerners came, may have helped you get that ability to kind of dive deep into a place. Would you say that's maybe true?
Yeah, I guess there's some connection there. I mean, they're sort of like two different worlds of my life, surfing and political journalism. But
sure.
I had an editor for a long time. He just retired, who used to say, you were preparing for this your whole life, this the kind of international stuff. I mean, not all my work is international. I do a lot of American pieces, too. But the idea of us kind of dropping into a strange place where you don't know the language, you don't know what's going on, and you have to learn quickly and get your bearings and find out, well, in the case of surfing, you know, where the waves might be and when and how, and, you know, kind of basic coastal and oceanographic information. In the case of journalism, you know, where the power is, where the story might be, where the lines of conflict and alliance are.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had this idea that, you know, even though I seemed to spend my 20s as a surf bum just fooling around, I was actually preparing for this career as a foreign correspondent.
Yeah, well, that seems plausible. But I mean, still, you had been kind of a surf bum in a way. So coming from out of far left field as you did, I mean, you had a college degree, but, you know, you weren't a Harvard graduate. You weren't the usual things that would get you into the elite magazine, The New Yorker. How did that happen? How'd you get started?
I'd always read The New Yorker. My parents subscribed and kind of aspired to the magazine without being very even clear about that with myself. That is, I can find in my journals over the years, you know, notes for a letter from Queensland or, you know, wherever I happen to be living. I was always, you know, keeping notes for a New Yorker letter from, which I never wrote, but always had in the back of my mind. And then once I came back to the U.S. from that long surf trip and started working as a freelance journalist, and, you know, kind of decided no more day jobs. I'm just going to make a living by writing or not, which meant I went back and, you know, lived with my parents for a while because I was completely broke. But I started writing for other magazines, freelancing around. I was in Central America for another magazine reporting on the war in Nicaragua. This is in the early, mid-80s. And I got an idea for a short New Yorker piece, which I just wrote and sent to them, you know, over the transom. And they bought and published. So that's how I got started there, just with a kind of blind submission. And then the editor was quite encouraging. You know, were there other things I wanted to write about? And I got started. It wasn't too hard to crack, or at least I got lucky.
Yeah, the editor was a kind of an iconic guy named William Shawn, and somehow I think you must have connected with him in some way, where he sort of grabbed hold of your work and immediately started using you in the magazine.
Yeah, he was really kind to me. He was a great editor, and before my first book about South Africa was published, asked if I would go back to South Africa for the magazine. And these were in the days when, if you published something critical of apartheid, of the system in South Africa, the government would see to it that you didn't come back and they wouldn't issue you a visa. So I thought it would be a good time to go before that book came out.
Right.
And so The New Yorker sent me, and I was there a couple of months, a long reporting piece, came back just in time for the publication. So he really got me started, and that piece worked out. Also came out as a book. I really owed my start at The New Yorker to him completely.
Apart from Sri Lanka that you mentioned, you've worked in and written about wars and civil unrest in, gosh, all kinds of places, Mozambique, southern Sudan, Somalia, Peru, and other places. Why don't you tell us about a couple of them where you got the most engaged, Bill?
Well, I was in Mozambique quite a while, also for The New Yorker at first, later for a book. There was a civil war there, really terrible civil war, so it consumed the whole country for many, many years, and was linked to the situation in South Africa. It was a Portuguese colony, which had achieved independence in the mid-70s, and then immediately a civil war jumped up that was sponsored by the sort of last bastions of white supremacism in southern Africa, first Rhodesia, and then South Africa. So it was a very muddled situation. The book I wrote was called A Complicated War, trying to understand what parts of it were a proxy war and what parts of it had a, you know, a social base, a sort of indigenous rationale. I mean, the rebels, were they, you know, working for South African government, or were they actually representing local grievances? So that was a very complicated, long reporting project. And blessedly, you know, peace came to Mozambique, and it's slowly come out of the devastation of those years. Other places in East Africa that really grabbed me, Somalia in the 90s. I don't know if your listeners will remember the U.S. intervention there in the mid-90s. Well, it was actually the United Nations, but U.S. led a big intervention to end a famine, which was the result of a civil war, and the famine did end. But the big objective of establishing a new government, because there was no government in Somalia at that point, was a failure. The UN finally pulled out in 95 and just kind of washed their hands of it, which I thought was kind of a good time to be there reporting. So I was there for the UN pullout and then stayed and wrote about how Somalia was somehow governing itself without a government. A really fascinating place.
Sounds a little risky. You've written about the drug wars in Mexico and the increasing social and political instability there. What's it like being on the scene, investigating drug gangs? I mean, were you looking over your shoulder a lot? Do you speak Spanish well enough to know when they were talking about you and that kind of thing?
I do speak Spanish well enough to get that part, and I think. And I don't know. It's a lot of the places I've reported from in Mexico are, you know, cartel-controlled places or places where, you know, the organized crime is a big, I mean, that's just the inescapable subject in Mexico. But often it, you know, it overlaps with the government. And there's a tremendous corruption problem in Mexico, which can be indistinguishable from organized crime. And yet most, I haven't felt personally imperiled much at all in Mexico. But you imperil people by talking to them, you know, in particularly in intense places, where people are liable to be punished for talking to an outsider. And it's often hard to see that, you know, things seem peaceful and you go to see the people you're interested in and talk to them. But slowly you realize that, you know, people see you go into their house or into their office or, you know, and you're some gringo and everybody's very suspicious of everybody else. And then things happen, you know, different factions, maybe it's the army versus the cartel or the police versus the army. I mean, crazy amount of conflict in Mexico that's very hard to define. But people are really terrified to stick their heads up above the parapet, so to speak. I mean, for very good reasons. It's really, really dangerous. And, for locals, not for the outsider. I mean, it's been a long, long time since any foreign journalist has had serious problems in Mexico.
Oh, really?
Local journalists, on the other hand, are right in the firing line. It's one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist in the world. And as a foreigner, you have to start thinking, though, about who you are endangering by speaking to them and by what you're saying and what you're asking. And so you have to develop some sensitivity in that area.
Wow. Oh, that's kind of tricky. You're toxic and don't know it. At least initially, and you're endangering them by just being near them, and they're risking their lives, and you have no idea. That's kind of a weird situation.
Yeah, and people are too polite usually to tell you. I mean, once or twice, once in particular in a state called Michoacán, I remember I was asking a guy, I'd been there for a while and knew a lot, was trying to get down to the nitty-gritty of, you know, who cut off whose head and why. And I was interviewing a guy, and I mentioned someone had been decapitated and turned to be a friend of his, and he just lost his temper and read me the Riot Act about how I was endangering people all over town by talking to them, including him. He said, they're listening to us right now. And I thought he was, you know, exaggerating. But the more I knew about that town and what was going on, the more I realized he was right. You know, I thought people were being scaredy cats by not talking to me. Why are you so afraid to talk to me? But I realized they had very good reason to be afraid.
You're listening to us right now on American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with William Finnegan, who's an award-winning political journalist, about his career doing that thing. Kind of came off a previous show about his early days where he was pretty much a world-traveling surf bum and somehow managed to make the big leap across into being a distinguished professional in the journalistic world, writing mainly for New Yorker magazine. Did you try, Bill, initially to keep your surfing life in the closet while getting established as a journalist?
Not consciously, but then I realized that I didn't want to come out of the closet, as it were. Once I was working at The New Yorker and I was writing a lot of editorials as well as reported pieces, and, you know, so involved in policy debates, U.S. foreign policy or criminal justice policy. I mean, things that I was writing about and cared about. And but I had kind of foolishly proposed to William Shawn, the editor we were discussing, a profile of this guy in San Francisco, Mark Reniker, this big wave surfer, who was quite a colorful character, whom I could picture in the pages of the New Yorker. I just kind of rashly proposed the thing, and he'd said yes. So this was on the books for me to write, and I took 7 years to write it because I missed a couple of deadlines in there. Because I realized, I mean, among other things, that I wasn't sure that, you know, having become a political journalist, I wanted other people to know that I was a surfer. You know, surfers don't have a great reputation for being well-informed. And I just suddenly thought, I'm going to be dismissed. People are going to say, oh, what? You're just a dumb surfer. We don't need to listen to you, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I eventually did finish the piece, and it ran in two parts in the magazine. And people were a little surprised, I think, but actually nobody said anything. That what I feared didn't happen. But it was a slow, a nervous process.
Well, I think you may have been well enough established already that you had credibility, and so they just kind of viewed that as a bonus add-on. Whoa, this guy had another cool dimension to him that we didn't know about, so maybe that was the way that went. Well, tell us about your most recent book, Cold New World, Growing Up in a Harder Country.
That was actually my most recent book was Barbarian Days, memoir about surfing. Yeah, all my previous books have been much more journalistic, and Cold New World is a big project. It was trying to look at young people, downwardly mobile communities around the U.S. I ended up focusing on four families in different parts of the U.S., both, you know, north, south, east, west, black, white, Latino. And sort of pockets, this was in the 90s, where, except for a kind of recession at the beginning and then regional recessions, the economy was growing and it wasn't a time of great downward mobility. But wages were kind of stagnated. And I was looking at places that were worse than stagnated, that were really downward and mobile, inner city communities, a rural southern community, and how kids were reacting. And so it was a sort of dense, very narrative, but also analytic look at all this stuff. And some people have pulled out the last section of that book was about a group of white kids, mainly neo-Nazis, skinheads, their community was kind of panicked about white downward mobility in this area and black and Latino upward mobility. This is outside Los Angeles. And a number of people have pulled that section of the book out and said, oh, look at this. You predicted Trump, you know, all this stuff about sort of white working class panic and anger. And it's not true at all. I did not predict Trump. I could never have predicted Trump. But that subject has kind of come to the fore since, and Cold New World was an attempt to, look at really people who had at that point no voice and still don't. I mean, I wouldn't say that Trumpism or his presidency represents the kind of people I was writing about at all, but they're still there and still having a tough time.
Have you ever written a piece that you later felt had an impact in the political real world? I mean, you know, you mentioned Trumpism or whatever, but maybe in terrorist intervention or in the course that internal politics took in some country where you could see that what you had written kind of turned the ship a little bit in some way.
Well, that's one thing one really sort of hopes for. I don't know that I've ever had any significant effect, any sort of positive effect. I mean, I've exposed a few things and made some powerful people uncomfortable. I did a piece probably 8-10 years ago about this sheriff in Phoenix, Joe Arpaio, sort of he's a friend of Trump's, kind of a notorious character that I think embarrassed him quite a bit. It didn't stop him. I wrote a lot about Mozambique, I mentioned, when the war was raging there and was really caught up in the, there was a question about U.S. support for the rebels at the time. I thought that was a really bad idea. But the way I wrote about Mozambique, I was afraid might encourage the supporters in Congress of that, who in fact got in touch with me after the piece came out and wanted me to you know, talk to them about why we should support the rebels. And so that was a sort of horrifying possible effect that didn't ended up not happening. I mean, I really tried to split the difference in what I was describing so not to give them too much ammunition. Hmm. So one worries about that kind of thing. And in some pieces, you feel like you've, you know, corrected the record. I did a piece about a sort of drug scandal in East Texas, area called Deep East Texas, that had been kind of blamed on an old sheriff there. I ended up thinking he had nothing to do with it, and he was kind of the hero of the story, actually. And so for, you know, local purposes, my piece, which was long and very complicated, sort of corrected the record, and I think stands as the way people remember that episode now. And then there are the individuals that I write about who sometimes I mention. You asked about Cold New World. I'm writing about underprivileged kids in some of those places, and a couple of them have said that, you know, the time I spent with them and the attention I got them had a good effect on their lives. They were, you know, caught up in drug dealing or neo-Nazism or whatever it was, and they may have, you know, suffered the consequences of that, but that their exposure to my world and the New Yorker was helpful in the end. That kind of thing makes you feel good.
Yeah, well, those are good things, and that's more impact than most people have. If you're, you know, repairing cars or working for the government or whatever you might do, that's those are accomplishments. So with all your achievements in a busy working life, what's the one you're proudest of? I mean, besides the surfing book.
Writing-wise, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, there's the response that your work gets, and, you know, if you get more positive response, you think, oh, that must have been my best work, but you're not really sure that's true. So there's nothing that really stands out that I think is, you know, was the best thing or the most difficult thing I've done. I mean, in life, proudest achievement by far is my daughter, who's 16 and just an absolute sweetheart. And, she's not an achievement, of course, but I'm not proud of anything I've done so much as I am of her.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like a lot of foreign correspondents, you seem to be attracted to dangerous situations. Maybe there's a mixture of adrenaline, like in surfing big waves, along with the interest in exploring social justice issues. What do you think? Are you an adrenaline junkie to some extent?
I don't know if I am, but it's true that there's, you know, with surfing, I'm not a big wave surfer. Those are very specialized guys. But I, you know, like a lot of surfers, I have my limits, and I like to surf up kind of near my limits. And that's really where the action is, the sort of goal is with surfing generally, is to surf right at the edge of the sort of disaster. And of course, you're trying to avert that. And the experience you're looking for is right next to that. It's, you know, the membrane can be quite thin between the two, the sort of mm-hmm. pinnacle experience and the disaster.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's plenty of adrenaline going there. And sometimes that's true in reporting too, that the best stuff, you know, the part of the story that really zooms is also quite close to some kind of, you know, whether it's a shooting, you know, a battle or a kind of just hairy situation that other mm-hmm. people haven't wanted to check out. You mentioned Peru. I was in a remote part of the Andes a couple of years ago writing about illegal gold mining up there and, you know, sort of deep in the mines with these guys who, indigenous miners who are doing it by hand and believe in these sort of ancient pre-Inca gods and luck that they'll bring them. You know, it's not a place where my readers are likely to find themselves. So that's sort of where you find the story, and it's got its kind of discomforts and its nervousness. So I don't know if that makes me an adrenaline junkie, but that's where I need to get for what I want.
I have an idea from having read your book and from hearing a little bit about and reading a little bit about your political journalism that you have led a charmed life. I think you may have some kind of guardian angel, if there is such a thing, because you've spent a lot of time being close to that membrane you talked about and come away with nothing more than a scratch or a bloody nose, I think so anyway. Well, we have just a minute or so left, so I know you've been surfing for like at least 40 years. Are you still surfing?
Yeah, I am still surfing. I think it's more than 50 years now. I take surf trips when I can. I live in New York City, but we actually get quite good waves around here. I mean, this has been a really good winter. And it's cold, of course, in the winter, but wetsuits are good now. And it's not so well known. The waves in, well, on the Jersey Shore, I live in Manhattan, so just south of here, or out on the south shore of Long Island, east of here, depending on the wind, we get quite good waves. So I'm getting in the water still quite a bit. Surfing worse and worse, though, unfortunately. you just get sort of weaker and slower with age, and you know how to do it, but you just, what's the expression? The spirit's willing, but the body is.
Yeah. Not or something. Yeah, you mentioned in your book somewhere that somebody said that as you get older, you slowly slide back into being a kook, which is a surfing expression for a beginning surfer. So you go from being beginner to expert and then kind of back to your second childhood where you're a kook again.
Which is, you got to try and develop a good attitude about it.
And age gracefully as a surfer and as a person in general, right? So, you know, your parents, you mentioned, were both successful TV and film producers, and they were, in reading about them in your book a little bit, very entrepreneurial and creative people. So this is kind of a silly question, but were they worried about you during your surfing days when you pretty much disappeared for years at a time?
I don't think so. That is, they were amazingly lenient with me and sort of gave me my head, let me pursue my interests, even when it seemed like I was never going to grow up or have any kind of career. And although when I went on that long, long safari, as you called it, around the world in my 20s, they encouraged me as I left the U.S., but I think that they didn't really think I'd be gone so long. And after about 3 years, they were getting kind of fed up and actually came and visited me in Cape Town where I was teaching high school. And 'cause I don't think they were afraid, but they were saying, you know, enough's enough. And indeed, I came back about a year and a half later.
You're not going to be able to re-enter. So pull out, pull out. Well, I think you said in your book that your dad at one point had wanted you to be a journalist. So I suspect he ended up being proud of you, right?
Yeah, it was sort of a long way around. I mean, I wanted to be a poet and a novelist, and he was encouraging me to be more practical. He'd wanted to be a journalist. In fact, he was a news writer at CBS when I was born. But he then went into production and sort of worked his way up from, you know, carpenter and assistant director to up to producing of eventually TV and movies. But he'd always, I think, was a kind of frustrated writer and wanted to see me do that. But I wrote not for publication for a long time, which I think was frustrating for him. And then eventually started publishing, and he's no longer with us, but he was around for the first half of my career at The New Yorker, at least, or more. And I think he was. I've actually learned while traveling, doing publicity for my latest book, Barbarian Days, people come up to me sometimes and say, "Oh, I knew your dad." And they'll tell me stories. "He was so proud of you. Like, he gave me your first book," that kind of thing. And it really gets me because, you know, he was a gruff old guy in his way, and he never let me know he was that proud of me. But I've sort of heard things since he's passed that have really got me.
That's the way it often happens. Bill, we are going to have to leave it there. William Finnegan, thank you so much for being on with us. It's been fascinating.
Yeah, it's been fun, Court.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.